been inevitable, that his helpless pursuit of her had been beyond his control, given how completely she had captured his heart that night. He was her slave, after all. Except he wasn't. He was a foolish youth who had convinced himself he was in love with a beautiful, but, on occasion, deeply unpleasant girl. He had made a choice, because a free mind can do such things. And in time he had learned what it was to have no freedom at all, not in mind or body. Until now, Cirrus had been shutting out the other spoiled. The babble of their minds in the midst of battle, a low, ugly murmur at the edge of his consciousness. Now he let them in, all of them, and shared the gift of long-dead drakes. At first, it was like pouring cold water on white-hot coals. Thousands of spoiled minds, snatched from the fury and chaos of battle, roiled in confusion as the gift spread through the multitude. Some slipped instantly into madness, their minds breaking at the sudden intrusion of a sensation they had never suspected might return. Others fought it, raging against the separation from the all-powerful consciousness of their white god. But most welcomed it, joy filling them as the invisible shackles fell away. As the gift leapt from mind to mind like a fire let loose in a dry forest, Cirrus felt more and more souls blink out of existence. "They're dying," he realized, pausing to look through the eyes of a spoiled, seeing those around him standing still, faces drawn in wonder or shock as bullets and cannon flayed them from above. "I'm killing them." The thought was accompanied by panic that came from an awareness of how little time he had left. Cirrus flitted from mind to mind, searching the now silent and immobile army for a soul that might save them, finding it close to the redoubt gates. He found Forest Spear lying only seconds from death, as his life seeped out from the many bullet holes in his chest, his mind filled with memories of his days hunting through the jungle with his brother warriors. Cirrus touched minds with him, feeling a pulse of gratitude before the darkness fell. He moved on, finding Veil Mist under a mound of dead and dying spoiled. There were hundreds of them, all seemingly cut down in an instant, by what means Cirrus couldn't know. Veil Mist had survived the calamity, but the weight of so many corpses would soon crush the air from her lungs. "Help her!" Cirrus commanded. The spoiled were slow to respond, some stumbling in confusion, others taking advantage of their newfound liberty to rejoice in the novelty of refusal.
"Please," he added. "You know me. I want you to live. All of you."
He felt a pulse of recognition run through them, shot through with a sense of trust and empathy. He had been a slave like them, and now they felt his desperate desire to preserve their lives. Several hundred spoiled surged towards the gates, braving the continuing fire from the walls above to drag Veil Mist from beneath the mound of corpses.
"Get them away from the walls," Cirrus told her.
He found the islander's mind warm with welcome and a seemingly endless well of gratitude.
"Where are you?" she asked. "We will come to you."
"It doesn't matter. Just..."
Cirrus felt a growing chill creep over the fringes of his awareness, the combined vision of so many eyes rapidly eroding, shrinking to just a few images, one of which brought a fierce, urgent need to cling on to life.
"The white!"
He could see it, mighty wings spread wide as it came to earth on the plain, the slim figure of Cathlin slipping from its back. Lying nearby was the body of a large black drake.
"It's there,"
he told them, putting every ounce of will and strength he could in the thought, the last command he would ever give to this army.
"Kill it!"
The spoiled left him then, the tumult of rage and bloodlust fading away. He blinked and found himself looking up into Decayla's eyes once more. He raised a hand, pressing it to her cheek, and took joy in the affection he saw in her face. A face he found himself content to take with him into the dark. Chapter 56. Clay. For a time he lay stunned. Vision clouded as he sought to refill his lungs, the ominous sound of fast-approaching wings loud in his ears, until it was swallowed by the roar of engines. He blinked, vision clearing to reveal Lizanne staring at him from the hatchway of her aerostat. It hovered above, engines pointed towards the ground. He lifted a hand to wave in greeting, but then a loud, ragged exhalation drew his gaze, and he saw Lutheron lying some 20 yards away, wings flapping and tail coiling weakly. Clay tried to stand, found he couldn't, and cursed as he reached for the product in his duster, drinking down a full flask of green. Rising to his feet, he half stumbled to Lutheron's side, letting out a groan of dismay at the sight of his injuries. Ragged, deep gashes had been clawed into Lutheron's hide, leaving his chest and belly a gory mess. Blood welled from a bite mark in his neck as he tried to raise his head towards Clay. "Lie still, big fella," Clay told him, smoothing a hand over the black's brow as he looked into his eyes. He could feel his pain and fear and the gradually slowing beat of his heart. "It's fine. We did all we could," Clay said, exuding as much calmness as he could. "You don't have to stay on my account. They're waiting for you." He stood and watched the light fade from Lutheron's eyes, knowing that in his dying, Ethlyn would die with him, although the memory of both would live on as long as there were black drakes to carry it. He turned, hearing a change in the pitch of the aerostat's engine, watching as it came to Earth a short distance away. Lizanne emerged from the gondola, and they stood regarding each other, apparently neither having any notion of what to say. Finally, she said, "Do you have any green? I'm running short." "Yeah, I got another flask." He began to reach into his duster, then his gaze jerked back to the aerostat as the air became filled with the sound of roaring flames. The white reared up from beyond the curved bulk of the aerostat, flames jetting from its mouth to bathe the craft from end to end. Clay gaped in shock as Lizanne, instead of running clear, immediately leapt back inside. He dragged his satchel round, pulling out a grenade before reaching for his product once again. He gulped down some black and focused his gaze on the white, now in the process of crouching amidst the smoke from the burning craft. Clay raised the grenade, summoning his black in preparation, then found himself in the air, the grenade flying away to explode harmlessly well wide of its target. He landed a good 50 yards from Lutheron's body, the green in his veins preventing serious injury, though he was obliged to spend several seconds lying stunned before managing to scramble to his feet.
"Gutter-born bastard!"
Kathleen advanced through the grass towards him, weaving from side to side as if drunk, blood streaming through the fingers she had pressed to the wound in her stomach. "Guess I'm a decent shot after all," Clay concluded. Much of Kathleen's golden hair had been burned away, leaving behind a seared and smoking scalp. Her skin was marble white from loss of blood, but her red-black eyes glowed bright, lit with a vibrant hatred. She screamed as she sent another wave of black towards him, Clay leaping to the side with green-assisted speed and replying with a burst of his own. It struck her squarely in the chest, sending her flat on her back. Clay leapt high, focusing his gaze on Kathleen's prone form, intending to expend all the remaining black in crushing her into the ground until she was just a red smear on the earth. The white's tail slammed into his midriff, sending him spinning in the opposite direction. Had the tail still possessed its spearpoint tip, The blow would certainly have been fatal. Instead of inflicting enough agonizing pain to leave Clay stunned and helpless as he rolled to a halt. He heard the white's claws scrape at the earth as it came closer, moving with unhurried intent. Looking up, Clay saw its head poised above, blackened and bleeding from his grenade, but possessed of a gaze as knowing and full of malice as he remembered.
"Hate me as much as I hate you, huh?"
Clay asked it in a pained grunt.
"Guess that's fair. It's what we do, us folks, us people. Hate's what's worst about us, and grows worse with the hating. You were made to hate, because we made you."
The white let out a faint huff of smoke, head tilting as if in consideration. Clay had no notion of whether it understood him, or even if it cared for anything beyond its own malice. But somehow he had given it pause, and that was all he needed.
"Got something for you," Clay said. "Gonna make you hate me even more."
He snapped his gaze to the side, focusing on Kathleen. She had managed to get back on her feet and resumed her stumbling walk towards him, eyes glowing bright as ever. Clay used all his black at once, unleashing it too fast for her to deflect or evade. In one swift motion, he reached out to grasp her neck with an invisible hand and snap it. The white let out a roar as Kathleen's body collapsed, rearing back from Clay, shaking its head in confusion. Clay fumbled for his satchel, clumsy hands trying and failing to grasp a grenade. By the time he had managed to drag one of the devices free of the satchel, the white appeared to have recovered some of its senses, turning back to him and rearing up, a haze of heated air forming around its mouth. Then it stopped. The white stood frozen, the flames blossoming from its jaw, but shooting into the air instead of at Clay. His gaze swiveled to the aerostat, now a smoking ruin, but standing in the foreground was Lizanne, staring fixedly at the white as she directed her black at it. Slumped on her knees at Lizanne's side was a young woman Clay didn't know, but evidently also a bloodblessed from the signature black-fueled focus with which she stared at the white. Clay's gaze swung back to the beast, seeing how it shook in the invisible chains that bound it, neck slowly coiling as it fought against its bonds, its head inching closer to the point where its still blossoming flames could be brought to bear on its victim. Clay hooked a finger into the grenade's ring and pulled, letting out a shout of pure agony when his broken digit lost purchase. Spitting curses, he switched hands, sweat bathing his scalp as the heat bore down, then disappeared. He looked up to see the white drowning in a dark wave. Lizanne's black had faded, and it thrashed and flamed in the tide that swamped it, biting and tearing as the wave swept over it, a wave of flesh rather than water. The white continued to fight, its tail and claws leaving dozens of spoiled, rent and dying, others blasted by flame or snapped in two by its jaws. But the weight of numbers proved unstoppable. The spoiled tore at the white with their claws, stabbed it with their bayonets, or hacked at it with their war clubs. Blood and scraps of scaled flesh rose in a cloud as they bore the beast down, thousands of them crowding in to rend at the beast in a crimson fog. Clay was struck by the fury on their faces, lacking the blank purpose he had witnessed in Lizanne's shared memories. The spoiled, like the white, had learned to hate. Their destruction of the white took place in silence, free of shouts or screams of vengeance, the only sounds the wet tearing of the huge drake's flesh and its last few guttural breaths. When it was over, Clay found himself surrounded by spoiled, all standing in immobile silence. He started to rise, finding it difficult and jerking in instinctive fear when the spoiled helped him up. Looking around, he saw that most of them regarded him with curious, even expectant faces, like an audience waiting for a speech. One of them soon worked her way through the throng towards him, a diminutive female with the blonde hair typical of island folk. She addressed him in perfect Mandalorian, with a slight managerial accent, her tone formal, if a little guarded.
"On behalf of those present," she said, "I offer our surrender, but we have conditions."
Chapter 57 Lizanne. They burned Cirrus on a pyre constructed atop the hill where he died. The spoiled lay his body on a pile of green corpses, the plain being so lacking in trees. The bones and shredded flesh that constituted the White's remains were added to the pile, along with the bodies of the two juveniles. The body of Kathleen Jewsmine had been left where it lay, none of the spoiled showing the slightest inclination towards touching it. When it was done, Lizanne injected red, whilst Clay drank a vial, and together they blasted the pyre with heat, the blaze soon consuming its grisly fuel and birthing a thick, foul-smelling smoke that rose into the darkening sky. Lizanne retreated from the fierce heat, pausing when she saw Clay lingering. Something clutched in his hand as he stared into the flames. He stood with a slight stoop, his face drawn in a persistent pain, large doses of green had yet to erase, and she worried what internal injuries he might have suffered. "He looks like an old man," she thought. She ran a hand through her hair, thick with sweat and assorted grime, and it occurred to her that her own appearance was hardly any more edifying. "What's that?" she asked him, nodding at the object in his hand. He glanced at her, holding it up. It was a vial, the contents impossible to discern in the glow of the fire. "Just some old product," he said, tossing it into the flames. "Reckon it's gone bad." They moved back, Lizanne going to Takela's side and drawing her into an embrace when she saw the tears streaking her face.
"I'm sorry,"
Takela sobbed into her shoulder.
"For flying off."
"So you should be." Lizanne drew back a little, smoothing the hair away from Takela's face. "Need to get some green on those scars," she said, reaching to extract a vial from her spider.
"Leave it,"
Takela said, turning back to the fire and resting her head on Lizanne's shoulder.
"They're not so bad."
The surrounding spoiled, several thousand strong, stood around the hilltop in silence as they watched the fire consume their general. Lizanne could see their brows twitching and knew that however still their voices might be, the mind of every living spoiled was joined in grief. She had used her scant remaining blue to trance with Sophia Griffin, requesting that she communicate the terms of the spoiled surrender to Captain Trumaine and the rest of the Verestian Defense League's high command. She found the woman's trance had changed, the dark forest regaining some color, though there was a guarded feeling to it, the air shot through with an aura of tense expectation.
"Something to tell me?"
Lizanne had asked her. Sophia's trance thrummed with momentary indecision before she replied, Lizanne discerning a great deal more from her thoughts than her words.
"The Free Protectorate fleet has arrived," she said. "Captain Trumaine has accepted a commission as Commodore." "How fortuitous for him,"
Lizanne observed.
"Their arrival was fortuitous for all of us,"
Sophia returned.
"Had they not, the battle might have gone against. How long have you been in contact with Exceptional Initiatives?"
The sky above the forest turned a faint shade of red, Lizanne detecting both shame and defiance in Sophia's emotions.
"I recall asking you to pass on the weapons designs to the Protectorate,"
Lizanne continued.
"I said nothing about Exceptional Initiatives. I assume the Protectorate never actually received the designs. What else have you told them, Sophia?" "I have a child to think of,"
Sophia replied, her mindscape darkening into something windswept and hostile.
I should like them to grow up in as safe and comfortable a place as possible.
Was contacting Exceptional Initiatives Captain Trumaine's idea or yours? The wind grew stiffer, twisting the branches of the surrounding trees so that they resembled snakes coiling for a strike.
The captain has been a good and loyal friend in these difficult times,
Sophia replied, Lizanne sensing a dangerous edge to her thoughts.
I am glad to find you recovered from your grief,
Lizanne told her and ended the trance.
Come on,
she said, taking hold of Takela's hand and moving to Clay's side.
The Superior, she said. Have you tranced with anyone on board?
He nodded. Lieutenant Sigarol says they've taken some bad knocks, but she's still afloat.
Good. We have to go.
She turned, leading him towards the Firefly.
Now.
Morva slipped into unconsciousness during the flight to the redoubt. Lizanne and Clay carried her to the subterranean chamber where the League had established a makeshift hospital. It was full of wounded, the air musty with stale blood, and filled with the constant murmuration of hundreds of people in pain.
Lucky we're not wanting for green,
a grey-faced doctor told Lizanne as he examined Morva. She and Clay had been obliged to remove a recently expired Verestian pirate in order to provide an empty bed.
Plenty of drakes piled up outside. The harvesters are working flat out to refine it.
The doctor lifted the lid of Morva's right eye, grunting in satisfaction.
She's still with us, he said, and her pulse is strong.
His expression grew more severe as he turned his gaze to Morva's burn-covered legs.
As for these, use any amount of green necessary,
Lizanne instructed. Seeing the implacable glint in her eye, he nodded.
It'll repair much of the tissue damage, but the scars... A Lacaris is always proud of their scars.
Lizanne turned to find a bedraggled Alzar Lacaris striding towards them, his gaze dark as he surveyed his adopted niece.
Especially when earned in battle,
he added in a more subdued tone. He jerked his head at the doctor, sending the man scurrying to fetch the product.
So,
Alzar said, Lizanne seeing how his hand hovered near Morva's.
It appears we have a victory, Miss Blood.
One with her help, Lizanne said. Your niece had a hand in killing the White. Is that sufficient to finally win your approval, Captain?
She was expecting anger, but he barely shrugged.
I didn't adopt her, you know, he said softly. Not truly.
I met to trade with some Dalcian Reavers. She escaped from the cage they had her in and stowed away on my ship. They came after us, thinking I'd stolen her. Reavers are not easily dissuaded from battle, so we fought. I lost crew that day, including my son. Lizanne saw him extend a finger to tap the back of Morva's hand. When it was over, I wanted to throw her to the King of the Deep, but I couldn't. She was just a little girl who took a chance at freedom. So I took her back to the High Wall, but I never let her call me father, only ever uncle.
Lizanne moved to Morva's side, smoothing back the hair from her head. She's my best pupil, she murmured, for some reason finding the unwelcome face of Madame Bondacieux coming to mind. At least I didn't try to kill her, she thought, pushing the image away. I have to go, she told Alzar. Will you stay with her?
My ship burned and sank, he replied. For the moment, it seems I have nowhere else to be.
Arbaris had his arm in a sling, the shoulder having been broken by a tail strike from one of the few greens to make it over the wall at the height of the battle. He appeared even more aged than Clay, face sagging with fatigue,
as he cast his gaze over the mass of bodies below the redoubt. They were thickest around the gates, piled up in a great ring around the crater, a legacy of the rocket fired by the Free Protectorate cruiser, now moored offshore along with a flotilla of 6 frigates. As a result of all the damage and destruction wrought on the Verestian ships, this small fleet now constituted the dominant maritime force on the globe. The bodies were a mix of spoiled and greens, though not every Drake had perished. The greens left alive after the battle had fled into the hills to the west, followed by the few surviving reds. However, the Zan doubted that a population of Drakes would continue for very long on Verestian territory. As they flew towards the redoubt, the Firefly passed over numerous sickly Drakes stumbling about the plain, both reds and greens. Some had already slumped into lifeless immobility, and Clay opined that it had only been the White's will that had sustained them so far from their birthplace.
"We're still counting," Arbaris said, gaze still preoccupied by the bodies. "It could be over 100,000 people died here. Ours and theirs."
Lizanne glanced back at the Firefly, waiting in the courtyard with Clay and Tekayla on board. She was keen to be gone, but required certain assurances first, and had little time to indulge his morbid reverie.
"General Arbaris," she said, voice clipped and formal.
It was enough to make him blink and turn towards her, a cautious frown on his brow.
"Back to business, is it?" he asked.
"The spoiled," she said. "I need to know their terms will be respected."
So far, the Verestians hadn't ventured closer than a mile to the hill where the spoiled congregated. The fact that the spoiled had kept their weapons and posted a cordon of cannon around their camp might have had a good deal to do with it.
"There are few in my command with the appetite for another battle," Arbaris replied. "However, that may well change as the days pass. It's a rare heart that can resist the lure of vengeance, and this army has a great deal to avenge."
"Evacuate the redoubt," Lizanne told him. "Hand it over to the spoiled. At least then they'll have a strong position to defend if the Verestians turn on them. In the meantime, I'll set about meeting the rest of their terms."
"You really think that's possible? After all this?"
"The corporate world may have fallen, but I suspect there are still bargains to be struck in the one that has replaced it."
A day later, the Firefly rendezvoused with the Superior, resting at anchor some 50 miles southeast of Blaska Sound. Tekayla skillfully steered the craft through a stiff crosswind to set her down on the aft deck. Clay, still stooping a little, but otherwise much recovered, was immediately embraced by his cousin and uncle as he stepped down from the gondola.
"How's Skaggs?" he asked them. "He'll live," Braddon Tallcreek assured him, "and got himself quite a scar to boast about for years to come." "Sorry about Preacher, uncle," Clay said. "Mad as a blue-addled rat he may have been, but I reckon I'll still miss him."
"At least he ain't around to be proven wrong," Braddon replied with a somber shrug. "All the 7 penitents were supposed to perish in the travail."
"An impressive machine, miss."
Lizanne turned to find herself confronted with a tall man she knew instantly, but hadn't actually met. Hylemore's gaze roamed over the Firefly in evident fascination, his military mind no doubt imagining all manner of practical uses for such a contraption.
"We had others that were more so," she said, extending her hand. "You, I assume, are Captain Hylemore."
"And you are Miss Lethbridge."
He gave a formal nod of his head as they shook hands.
"I'm glad to see you recovered," she said. "I had heard you were wounded."
"Just a bump on the head. The blast from that newfangled rocket gave us a pretty hard smack. I got off lightly compared to my helmsman, broken jaw. Still, at least it's shut him up for a while."
"Thank you for doing this.
I know you're risking much in undertaking this mission.
He gave a thin smile before replying. Yesterday I received a signal from Captain Trumaine to report aboard the Free Protectorate flagship as of this morning. I very much doubt he intended to offer warm congratulations and a captaincy in his new command.
Doesn't that make you a mutineer? An outlaw, perhaps?
Then little has changed. In any case, as far as I can ascertain, the laws that previously bound us no longer have meaning, which would make me a private individual free to sail wherever I wish. Luckily, the bulk of my crew seems to share my sentiments, for the time being at least.
Where will you go when this mission is complete?
My co-captain and I will retrieve her daughter from Stockholm. After that, Heilmore's smile broadened. I've a yen to do some exploring. My grandfather left a long shadow, one I've spent my life trying to match. But he was always more an explorer than a fighter. Perhaps that's the legacy I should be honoring from now on. Besides, Heilmore's gaze darkened somewhat. In a world that now has weapons like that rocket and your marvelous aerostat, the military path no longer has much appeal to me.
Without the Protectorate, how will you live?
A ship needs supplies, repairs from time to time. There are many ports in this world, all now bursting with stockpiled goods. There are always opportunities for an honest captain to turn a profit.
Lizanne turned as Tinkerer's lanky form emerged from the Firefly. He stood surveying the ship and its scorched decks and damaged fittings, his usually bland features betraying a certain trepidation.
"I've never been on a boat,"
he explained, catching Lizanne's eye.
"This is a ship, sir," Heilmore pointed out in polite but emphatic tones.
"I'm afraid you'll have to become accustomed to your passenger's manners, Captain," Lizanne said. "Give him a cabin to himself. Keep him supplied with pen, ink, and paper, and you'll find him mostly tolerable."
She went to Tinkerer, hesitating a moment before embracing him. His thin frame remained stiff and unresponsive, except for the soft pat to her shoulder.
"Are you sure about this?" she asked, drawing back. "Life in the new Mandalorian Republic might not be so bad."
"A prison is a prison, no matter how comfortable," he told her. "The memories the artisan left me are more interesting in any case. There is a great deal still to find and study. Also, weapons are boring. They only do one thing."
Lizanne went forward, finding Clay on the foredeck with a young woman she recognized from the trance.
"You have it?"
she asked after Clay made the introductions. Chris looked at him before replying. When he nodded, she reached for a chain about her neck, detaching a small vial and handing it to Lizanne.
"The formula,"
Chris added, giving Lizanne a strip of paper bearing a number of symbols.
"I have tried to mirror the chemical notations used in this age," she went on. "Although a plasmologist should conduct a thorough analysis before attempting to recreate it."
"The crystals?" Lizanne consigned both items to her pocket, then inclined her head towards the stern.
"Unloaded and awaiting your inspection. A fair trade, wouldn't you say?"
"Actually," Chris said, moving away,
"I believe I'm doing your world the greatest service by taking them where they won't be found."
Lizanne watched her leave before turning to Clay.
"Trance with me when you arrive," she said. "I should also like to be updated as to your progress, if you're so minded."
"Happy to. Might take a while to find all of Miss Ethlyn's notebooks. I'm thinking she had a lot of hidey holes scattered about the interior. We'll take a look at the enclave first. Make sure there are no more infant wights scuttling about."
He met her gaze, his expression growing more serious.
You really think they'll agree to this deal of yours? I know everything's changed and all, but you're asking them to give up the very thing that made the old world what it was. With this, Lizanne said, patting the pocket containing Chris's vial and formula, I suspect I could ask for all the tea in Dalcia, and there would be a long list of those willing to fight each other to give it to me. She paused, unsure of what to say next. They had shared so much in the trance that words now seemed inadequate, clumsy even. Goodbye, Mr. Torkreek, she said finally. It has been a very great honor.
I doubt that, he said. But thanks for saying it anyways. And for saving my life, of course. Occurs to me I hadn't said so before. They didn't embrace or even shake hands in farewell. It seemed strangely formal, even meaningless. Their minds would be joined for however many years they had left. Between them, there would never truly be a goodbye. Lizanne turned towards the stern at the sound of the Firefly's engine revving up. She gave him a final smile and went aft, greeting Braddon Torkreek along the way.
If you're ready, Captain.
He nodded and pulled his daughter into a crushing embrace. Lauriabeth blinked tears as he released her, saying,
Tell Ma I'll come see her soon.
Come with me and I won't have to, Braddon said.
Lauriabeth glanced at the Corventine Marine Lieutenant standing close by and lowered her head.
Sorry, Pa. I think it's time I found my own contracts.
Hylemore's hulking second-in-command barked out an order as Lizanne moved to board the Firefly, a line of sailors snapping to attention on the aft deck in response. The captain saluted as she climbed into the gondola, Braddon Torkreek following her after a moment's hesitation. She closed the hatch, and Takayla angled the engine to take them up.
Back to the mount, Lizanne told Takayla. I suspect Captain Trumaine has already arrived.
Lizanne turned her gaze to the starboard porthole and watched Superior shrink beneath them, Hylemore maintaining his salute until she could no longer make out his form. Soon the ship had become just a speck on a very big ocean, fading from view as they flew away. Epilogue 2. Madam Luella Tithencroft, Premier-elect, North Mandanorian Republic, Sonora. From Lizanne Lethridge, Co-Director, Mount Works Manufacturing Company, Blaska Sound, Forestia. Date 5th Labellum, 1601. Subject: Proposals regarding future relations between the Mount Works Manufacturing Company and the North Mandanorian Republic.
Dear Madam Premier, may I be so bold as to open this missive by offering my most sincere congratulations on your recent election. As you will no doubt be aware, news takes much longer to travel in these interesting times, so please forgive my tardiness in not writing sooner. But word of your appointment only reached us in the last few days. I assume that by now you will have been fulsomely briefed by Commodore Trumaine on the outcome of his visit to our facility at the close of recent hostilities. I write in furtherance of the discussion begun during that meeting, in the hope that its somewhat rancorous conclusion might be overturned and a more amicable basis for future cooperation established. Before I set out what I believe to be a sound basis for future negotiations, I should first like to address the situation regarding the large number of individuals currently residing on the Verestian Peninsula, commonly referred to as spoiled. I confess to harboring a distinct dislike for this particular term, but since an alternative eludes us, I shall employ it for the sake of brevity. As you will be aware, the spoiled currently occupy a fortified position on the peninsula, and so far remain unmolested by their Verestian neighbors. However, as time progresses, I hear ever more voices raised in objection to their continued presence, and consider it only a matter of time until some form of violent confrontation becomes inevitable. Furthermore, the spoiled themselves have no desire to remain in their current location. As stated in their original terms of surrender, it is their wish to be transported to the Eratzian continent. The situation is further complicated by the fact that the vast majority of Verestian captains refuse to entertain the prospect of having any spoiled aboard their ships. Many are also highly disinclined to sail to Eratzian waters, despite assurances that the danger of attack by Blues has now passed. Another salient issue relates to an aspect I feel certain Commodore Tremaine included at the forefront of his report to you, regarding a particular substance currently in my possession. I feel certain, Madam Premier, that a personage of your insight will require little explanation as to the importance of this substance. I also feel sure that the newly installed first citizen of the Corventine Republic will also require similarly minimal explanation, should I feel minded to bring it to her attention. This would be a simple matter to arrange, since I count General Arberus, Commander-in-Chief of the Corventine People's Freedom Army, as a personal friend. As to the nature of the substance itself, our own plasmologists have confirmed its efficacy as a synthetic substitute for the blue variety of draconic plasma. Please see the enclosed report, which details their findings in full, apart from several sections which have been redacted for reasons of corporate security. You'll note from the report summary that our plasmologists believe, subject to sufficient resources being made available, the knowledge gained from their analysis will in time enable production of synthetic versions of the other varieties of product, excepting white, of course, the chemical basis of which eludes our keenest plasmological minds. Turning to the matter at hand, I am prepared to surrender both the substance and the formula required for its production to the North Mandalorian Republic, subject to the agreement of the following contractual obligations. 1. The Eratzian continent will remain free of colonization for perpetuity, and there will be no further attempts to harvest drakes or breed them for harvesting purposes. 2. The North Mandalorian Republic will provide sufficient shipping to transport the spoiled to Eratzia as soon as can be arranged. Please note that these conditions are non-negotiable, and my offer is subject to expiry within 3 months of the date of this letter. Finally, returning to the subject of Commodore Tremaine's visit, I regret I was unable to assist the Commodore in his principal mission. However, I am not in a position to keep track of all my former employees. Also, I have no information regarding the true identity of the individual Commodore Tremaine was so keen to meet. We only knew him as Tinkerer. It is my hope to one day resume his acquaintance, but where or when that might come to pass is impossible to say at this juncture. Neither, contrary to Commodore Tremaine's oddly strenuous protestations, do I possess any knowledge regarding the whereabouts of the former Corventine Imperial Navy ship Superior, nor its captain, nor any of its crew. As to the crystals of bizarre nature, known to have been in the possession of the White, I must confess my complete ignorance as to their fate. The rocket fired by the Free Protectorate at the height of the Battle of the Redoubt unleashed an inordinate amount of explosive power, and I consider it highly probable the crystals were destroyed in the blast. I would request, in the interests of forging an amicable working relationship, that you no longer pursue this point, for I consider this particular matter is, and will remain forever, closed. I await your reply with the greatest interest, and look forward to many years of fruitful and mutually beneficial cooperation. Yours, Lizanne Lethbridge, Co-Director, Mount Works Manufacturing Company, Blasca Sound, Verestia.
This is Steve West. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Book 3 of the Draconis Memoria, The Empire of Ashes by Anthony Ryan. This program was directed by Kim Smith. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text copyright, 2018, by Anthony Ryan. Production copyright, 2018, Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.